Hello and welcome to Connectivity 243. I'm your host Nicholas Bray, and today I'm joined by Derek Andrews from Gradual Games.
Hello.
Hello. So Gradual Games is a small homebrew company that makes NES games. I've heard about you guys for a while, and I tried out a couple of your games, like the demos and stuff, but recently you've made your games available for free, basically. But yeah.
Yep, that's right. Yep, the free ROM downloads.
Yep. But before we get into that, I thought we'll just start off with basically let you sort of introduce yourself, some of the backstory on how you started Gradual Games, and we'll move into the actual games after that. So how did this all start, and how long have you been doing it, making homebrew NES games?
It's a rather long history of being into retro game development. Basically, when I was 13, I learned QBasic and got into programming RPGs and such. But to skip over a lot of history there, I eventually went to college. And when I was done with college, I decided I want to really get back into hobby programming. And I knew I liked programming games, and I wanted to get into some kind of game programming. And I nostalgically recalled coding in the DOS days with QBasic, as I just mentioned. And a coworker of mine teased me and said, "Oh, Derek likes old stuff." And I told him I like QBasic. So he pointed me to a website called NES Dev. And it's a website that's all devoted to programming for the old Nintendo Entertainment System. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I had a small amount of background in assembly language programming on DOS from doing some coding in the 90s, along with QBasic. And so I thought, hey, maybe I can learn this. So I eventually was pointed to a tutorial called the NES 101 tutorial and started tinkering around with it. And while I was spending time on NES Dev, I saw a guy make a game and actually release it on cartridge. His name was Sivak, and the name of the game was Battle Kid. It's one of the most popular NES homebrews ever made, I believe, one of the original ones. So once I saw that, I was amazed. You could actually write a game and put it on a cartridge. I was like, I have to do this. And so I also found out about a product from a company called Retro USB called the Power Pack, which enables you to put ROMs on a compact flash card, stick it in this cartridge, put it in the NES, and run software that you wrote. So I obtained a Power Pack and tinkered around with those tutorial programs. And once I saw my code running on my actual NES that I had, I was hooked. I decided, okay, I'm going to give myself the next, 5 years, as long as it takes, basically, to make my game. And it didn't wind up taking quite as long as 5 years. It took about 3.5 years, but I stuck with it and made Nomalus, our first NES game.
Mm-hmm.
That's not very detailed.
Sorry?
That was rather detailed.
No, that's good. That's good. Okay, so we may as well start talking about your first game, Nomalus, storming the castle. It's like a cat pun in there, which is basically as a platforming game starring a cat. So how long did it take to make that game, like a few years, or like where did, and how long did like it start to for you to actually get like stuff playable and get the graphics sort of started and all that sort of stuff, basically the process of how you went through making the first game?
Yeah, it was an interesting process, because once I got a little tutorial program running on the NES, what I really began doing at that point was starting to write small demos to show that I could make certain things happen on the NES. I like making a sprite move around, making a background scroll, taking input, playing sounds. And one of the earliest demos I got working was actually a little orange cat that I could slide around the screen. It didn't do really any game-like things. It didn't jump. It didn't shoot. It was just a cat sprite that was two animation frames, and I could just slide it around the screen. And it was loosely based on an orange cat game demo that I did program as a teenager in QBasic. So I sort of was starting there, and I eventually was able to persuade my wife, who is an artist, to help me, and sort of had to cajole and prod her for a while, but eventually she decided to help, and we had to have a lot of back and forth communicating about the constraints of the system, because you can't just draw whatever you want.
Yeah.
Any colors on the NES, everything has to be a subset of four colors, where one color is I'm kind of getting into the weeds there, but there's a lot of constraints that you have to pay attention to when you're creating art for the NES, and it took a while for my wife to get used to that. But once she did, and alongside actually coding for the NES, I would build tools to convert her art into data that could be displayed in the games. So I'd say after about maybe 6 months or so of tinkering with demos and building these tools I mentioned, we started to have something akin to a playable game. I think it might have been a little bit longer than that before it really seemed like a game. Probably about 9 months that it was actually like Nautilus walking through a scrolling level and killing one enemy, perhaps. Yeah. And then the ensuing almost 3 years was spent fleshing that out into a complete, albeit rather simple and basic platformer.
Yeah, I have played a little bit of it. I haven't finished it. Kind of found it a little hard, but I probably haven't put enough time into it. But I was playing on easy as well, so.
It's even harder and easy. I think one of the problems is when you're making your own game, if you're an amateur at it, which I definitely was making my first game, it's actually, you get so used to playing your own game, you think it's too easy because you have practice developing your own game. And then you hand it off to other people and they find it's very difficult. It's actually hard to make a really balanced game, which is something I learned the hard way by making Nautilus. But the funny thing is, a lot of people in the retro gaming scene actually really dig super, super hard games. So a lot of people in the scene actually lapped it right up.
Yeah. Like I have a tiny bit of like insight into that as well. Like just from Mario Maker and stuff, trying to balance like the Mario levels I was making Mario Maker to make it not too difficult or not too easy. But I imagine it's much more difficult trying to do that from scratch on your own game, like making ROM builds and then putting in the NES and then playing through that level. And were you the only one responsible for the level design?
So that's an interesting question. So I actually, for Nautilus, I had a good friend of mine named Dan actually help beta test the game quite extensively. He's very avid and a very good video game player. And he actually gave me a lot of feedback on the level design. I wouldn't say that he necessarily like changed the level design, but there was definitely a lot of tweaking that he suggested that helped prevent the game from feeling broken in parts or feeling too hard. Like there might be a certain part in the level where it's like you're very likely to have almost no health here. There should be an item, that kind of thing.
Yep. Just a play test sort of input, basically.
Yeah. In fact, I learned some really important things from working with him on Nautilus. Like he taught me about something called framing. Like if you have an attack that can be repeated the exact frame after it ends, then you can essentially make your character invincible as they're moving. So he had me put a pause in there so that after each attack, there's a few frames in which there's some opportunity to get hit. So then it's no longer broken. So he was very useful.
I will say, playing a little bit of it and like jumping around and stuff, the physics and the jumping feel like pretty good, because every now and then you play like a homebrew game or some amateur game and the jumping feels off or the physics feel just not quite comfortable. But I found Nautilus was actually quite good in that regard. Did you take any like inspiration from other NES platformers in trying to determine like the feel of like jumping and the physics? Or
that's a good question. I think my primary goal with Nautilus was to since it was my first game, and I had had some experience doing some professional software, not games, but professional software, so I knew how hard it was to make a piece of software with all the features in it that you want. So what I tried to do was create a game with as few features as I could possibly stand to have in it. So I had the platforming physics and like three weapons and very constrained horizontal movement. He only has one speed. He doesn't have variable speed horizontally. This is one speed. So I only really had to worry about variable speed in one dimension, which is jumping vertically and ejecting vertically. So that made things a lot easier. And as for the actual feel of the jump, I wouldn't say I based it specifically on any particular game. Once I had a jump working, I just tweaked the various settings that influence how high he jumps and so on till it felt good. As for the feel of the game, I think the most similar game to Anomalous in terms of the feel of the play is probably Ninja Gaiden, because there's so much of that game that you can charge through and slash with a sword and things will die in one hit. And there's a lot of enemies in Anomalous that feel that way. You can just charge through and chop through things. That's probably the most similar.
Yeah. Game. So when you're making an NES game, how's like the process? Like, are you staring at like just like text and code a lot of the time, or like some of those tools that you made? Did you make like you can see the graphics and sort of, you know, choose where to put things, or is it all sort of this position goes this number to this number sort of thing? And what's the sort of the basic progression? Is like you start with code, or you move into like the tile editor and do stuff, and then move. Like, how does that all fit together?
That's also a very good question. So I think that I usually start with tools and try to get it to output some very basic thing in a format that I design or brainstorm about in my journal. And then I take that chunk of data that the tool generated, put it in a program I'm working on, and then carefully break down the problem of reading that data and actually doing something with it. So I'd write like a, basically I have a set of two tools. And when I worked Anomalous, I actually wrote them in C# originally, but at this point I've rewritten everything in Python. So I have a graphics editor and a level editor. And with my graphics editor, I import just a raw ping or bitmap that my wife created, and turn that into CHR data and name table data. And then I have a various set of graphical tools in there to turn those into meta tiles or meta sprites and so on, which are larger chunks of data for arranging the various little tiles on the screen in the NES. Like with the level editor, it takes what the graphics editor output and creates meta tiles with which I can paint a level with tiles that are each 16 by 16 pixels in size. And then when I'm done painting the level and filling it with attributes and telling it where all enemies should be and where the hitboxes should be and everything else, I run an export step, which compresses the level in terms of larger tiles containing tiles in a raw byte format that I can paste into my assembly code. Mm-hmm. And it's from there that I'll start writing code to interpret that data, if that makes sense. It's a very iterative process. It's not like I do one and then the other. I'll do one and I'll write something in the tool that output something, and then I'll tinker with, you know, drawing just like a single row of tiles or something like that. Mm-hmm. And go back and forth till it's all a seamless system where I can just draw a level and import it and play it, which is where I'm at with my current game.
Yep. Yeah, I imagined it was like a bit of a back and forth, but I'm just, you know, I have no idea about programming and how to actually make an NES game. So I was trying to get a feel for the process and how you actually go about doing it. But so when you finished Anomalous, you actually put it out on a physical cartridge as well, right?
Yep.
So you can actually go and buy it. Can you still go and buy these physically?
Yes, yep. They're still, Anomalous and Alia are both available at infinitenslives.com.
Mm-hmm. So what was the process of going through getting your games put on like a physical cartridge and like packaging and trying to market the game and everything like that?
It was a pretty fun process. Originally, the first run of Nomalis was through RetroUSB.com, which is probably the most well-known company in the NES.
They make the retro ABS. I've got one of those.
So Nomalis was originally produced by them, and the process was fairly enjoyable. It involved working with RetroUSB and another guy named Uncle Tusk, who handled the printing the boxes, the manuals. And so a lot of the work was just me working with my wife to decide what's going to go on the box and what we're going to write on the box, and just designing the manual, and just a lot of back and forth there. And then just sending off the materials to the guy that produces the box and manuals, and sending the ROM to RetroUSB to produce the game. And that was it, basically. we didn't have to know very much about the hardware. The actual building of the cartridge is not something that we're experts at. All I had to do was make sure that the game itself was using the mapper that RetroUSB could supply cheaply, and we were sure of that early in the project, and so that worked out pretty well.
Okay, well, that's good. Yeah, because I guess not being as hands-on with the manufacturing is like a bit of a blessing. You don't have to try and contact factories or whatever in China or go through all that sort of stuff. So
yeah,
I guess it makes sense.
The cool thing is we actually eventually switched to Infinite NES Labs, and he still does all of our cartridge production, but he actually has made it pretty easy for people to self-publish their homebrews if they want, because he sells the PCBs and the cartridge shells and so on. So if you, and even a piece of hardware for flashing the PCBs yourself. So if you want to do the entire process yourself, all you have to do is buy these raw materials from Infinite NES Labs, and you can do the whole thing. Yeah. And some folks in the scene are really into that. They love doing all of the things and doing all the packaging and everything. But I'm quite happy to share the profits with the producer and have them handle that part, so I can just focus on building games myself. That's my preference.
Yep. So, okay, moving on. After Nomalis, you made a second game called Legends of Aulia. So what was the beginning of that project? I mean, the game is, for those who don't know, it's basically a similar game to like a Zelda sort of action RPG type game. Basically, how did the project start? Was it something you'd been thinking of during Nomalis, or something, an idea of like a story you've been thinking about for a few years? Or
so Aulia is fun because it was, well, actually both Nomalis and Aulia were originally ideas that came up with as a teenager trying to make games in QBasic. They were both very germinal ideas, like Cat's Little System, an orange cat in armor. And Aulia was just an RPG that somehow had owls in the story. I never actually figured out what the story should be or who the characters should be or anything. I had a playable demo back then, but it wasn't really, there wasn't much to it. So I just had this really germinal idea from back then. And with the help of my wife, we sort of spontaneously came up with this idea of having an elven princess be the main character, and that she would basically be a falconer, except instead of falcons, she'd have owls to help her. One owl in particular. And so that germinal idea became the basis of Aulia. And we sort of invented a not very deep storyline around that, that just involved your typical travel afar and defeat the evil demigod type story. And we decided to have it be like an evil merman decided to have the sea creature sort of rise out of the ocean and actually float in the air over the land. And we created a story around that. And I started tinkering with a new game engine that involved being able to scroll in all directions, as well as having screen-by-screen dungeon gameplay like Zelda, and eventually worked on having the main protagonist, Adlaniel, be able to throw the owl as an attack and then have the owl fly back to her, and then came up with several other techniques that the owl could perform that was based around that basic idea of having him fly out and do something and then return to you.
Yep.
And the whole game is based around that.
So, like, because it is sort of a Zelda-type game, it's a much more complicated game than Nomalis was as just a platformer. How did you approach the level design in, like, you know, flesh out the world and the dungeons. I mean, making dungeons is a lot harder than a platforming stage, generally, yeah. I'd assume. Puzzles and stuff, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was dramatically harder. I think that when I started the project, I didn't really fully grasp the potential scope that I was taking on in starting that project. And at one point, I was imagining it being a totally like open world, like Zelda, where you could go anywhere and enter any dungeon. And the only way to progress through the game is by having the item from this dungeon and to take it to this dungeon and so on. And you have to go to several different towns and get clues and all the different trappings of a truly open world game. And it eventually dawned on me, given the amount of time I'm able to devote to developing these games, that it would just be, I don't know, maybe a decade before I'd finish the game. So I decided to constrain the scope dramatically once I realized that, and basically turned it into a much more linear action adventure. So each world is sort of one fairly linear overworld where you have to basically do a fetch quest of gold in order to enter the dungeon. And then once you're in the dungeon, it's a more constrained, it's more of a maze. It's not as linear as the overworlds, but it's sort of several constrained and self-contained puzzles that you have to solve in order to perhaps find some keys to progress all the way to the boss. And so while these two things made the game much simpler than a truly open world, it enabled me to actually finish the project in a timely fashion and still make what I think turned out to be a pretty fun game anyway.
Yeah, I did play the demo back maybe last year or so, and I'm always meant to pick up the full game, but just never ended up getting around to it. But okay, so how long did it take to make the full game? Like how many years did it take you to make Ali in the end?
I think it took roughly 4 years. Like Nomalus, I believe, took about 3.5. Alia took a little bit longer. It was closer to four years.
And is there anything in Alia or Nomalus that you would, you know, like to have included? With Alia, it may have been, would you have wanted to make the scope, you know, what you imagined initially? Or like even just a few different ideas that didn't pan out during development of that game?
Yeah, I definitely would have liked to have made a truly open world game. But I think that given my level of experience with software development and game development in general, I think I wasn't quite ready to do that. Just because the scope was just really quite huge. So yeah, there were plenty of things I would have liked to have done, but my approach to the first two games, Nomalus and Ali, were really to try to keep the scope under control, because when I attempted to make these games as a teenager, I had no handle at all on scope. And so I made several different attempts at each game and would sort of, it would sort of balloon out of proportion until I could not make any progress at all. And quit several times with each attempt at each project. So in order to finish the projects, I decided, you know, I chose just a handful of features and built a game around those, and so that I could finish it.
So how long would Alia be as a game, do you like, estimate? Like how long does it take to get through the full version?
My the feedback I've received from people who play it for the first time, it's usually anywhere between 2 and 5 hours. If you know all the secrets and you're an expert at it, it takes not very much more than an hour to get through the whole game.
So yeah, I guess it's similar to other NES games, I guess, in scope.
I was a little sad that I couldn't make it longer, actually, because one of the biggest inspirations for Ali was Star Tropics, which actually is probably the biggest influence, because that's a fairly linear game, but it's if played all the way through, takes anywhere from 5 to 10 hours. I think it's a pretty big game. Like Ali wound up having about 5 worlds in it. It would have been nice to have upwards of maybe 8 or something. But
yeah, mm-hmm.
there were lots of things even with the art that made it really really tough in Ali, because when you have a side-scrolling platformer, the number of decisions you have to make about even composing objects on top of each other are simpler, even from an art perspective. But with Ali, with like the dungeons and so on, I had to have a lot of back and forth with the artist about having a little shadow in the corner and then a rock that could be on the shadow or not on the shadow. And so there are all these different compositions of objects that had to be pre-composed for the NES because you can't have layers NES like you can have on other systems. So there were many layers of complexity that had to be dealt with to make that game at all versus a side-scrolling platformer.
So yeah, when designing the game of Alia, did you have to think a lot about because it's a more non-linear game, and you can talk to people, you can sort of get hints and stuff. Was like there any point where like you had to, you know, try and be as concise as possible with the text, but also, you know, be able to relay enough information for the player to know, sort of get hints and where to go and stuff like that. Like you're just directing the player to where you want to go. Was that a thing that you had to consider?
That's a good question. As I mentioned, the game wound up not being a very open world, but there are various puzzles in the game. Some of them are pretty tough. And I did try to include some kind of hint for most of the puzzles in the game, most of the really tough ones anyway. There are quite a few puzzles which are by design ones that should be solvable by just working it out. But some of them were kind of obscure, but I did make sure to drop some hints in various parts of the game. So for example, there's a library in the first town that has a book on the shelf that has some obscure hints about puzzles that come much later in the game. And then there's a really tough puzzle in the Tundra dungeon for which there is a hint given to you by an NPC somewhere outside in the overworld. And it's also a rather obscure hint, but it is a hint and helps for one of the toughest puzzles in the game, I hope.
I just bring it up because I remember when I was running through the demo, I was lost in the forest area for a little bit. I was like, what should I do? I can't remember exactly what the problem was, but I think I couldn't get past the owl stops you, I think, at some point early on.
Yeah, when you try to leave that first forest area, the owl's like calling to you like mentally. And I think a lot of people have gotten stuck in that area. And the only hint that I really left for that is just an NPC in the town says that their husband saw an owl somewhere in the canopy of the forest. So it doesn't really give you much to go on. But it turns out you have to, and I'll drop just this hint about the game because it's right at the beginning. It's fine to do this. There's a tree out in the open on the sort of lower right portion of that first forest area, and all you have to do is touch the front of that tree, and it'll start a conversation with the king owl Silmaron. Then the game moves on from there. The puzzles and so on in the game are kind of obscure and frustrating, but which is very much in line with some of the old NES titles, which are similar.
Absolutely.
you almost have to know what to do in certain instances. So that's not necessarily a good thing, but since this was aimed at the retro NES community, a lot of people like that it had that sort of old, possibly slightly clunky puzzle solving element to it.
So you're working on another game right now. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how that's going and what sort of game it's going to be?
Yep, sure. So this game is called Trophy, and it's basically a totally unabashed knockoff of Mega Man. I'm not really attempting to innovate at all. Mega Man was one of my favorite series as a kid, and I just want to basically make a love letter to Mega Man. So that's what this game is going to be. Almost all elements of Mega Man are going to be in there. In fact, it's actually going to be slightly simpler than Mega Man. Instead of having like all 8 boxes give you a weapon, there's going to be like 3 upgrades hidden in the game. Mm-hmm. And another difference from Mega Man is most of the bosses in Mega Man were about the size of Mega Man. They were a small sprite-based boss that would have a various attack patterns and such. But in this game, all of the bosses are the huge scrolling kind that fill up a lot of the screen, and it's a big, scary creature or something.
Yeah, I've seen a screenshot you posted, and the boss is quite large. It's like, yeah, most of the screen, I guess, as you say. Like,
Yep. So this project's going quite well. We learned a lot about NES programming on both Nomalus and Aulia, and we're able to apply some of that knowledge to this. And my wife's continuing to help me with the art. She's also learned a lot, and we're able to obtain quite a few bits of reference material for Mega Man for this game. So she's using a lot of existing Mega Man enemies and levels as inspiration for the graphics she's creating for this game. So that makes things a lot easier as well. And furthermore, I learned a thing or two about composing music over the last 10 years of doing this. And I'm writing music for this game and trying to make it as Mega Man-y as possible. And that's probably one of the most fun parts for me, because ever since I was a kid, before I even knew I was going to make any games, I loved Mega Man music. And I thought, I want to write Mega Man music someday. So I'm doing it now and putting it in my own Mega Man knockoff. So it's quite fun.
So, like, how far into the development would you say you are? Are you getting towards the end, or?
Yeah, we're actually getting surprisingly close. We started this project overlapping with Aulia in early 2016, and we have completed all 9 bosses that are going to be in the game. So that's going to make it actually a larger, more expansive experience than both Nomalus or Aulia. We've got 9 bosses done, all of the background art for all the levels they occupy done. We have most of the small enemies done. We have the main character and his upgrades done. And we have most of the, I think I might have already said, most of the small enemies and such. And we've just started doing the level design. We just today are mostly done with the second of the 9 levels. So hopefully, we're hoping by the time MAGFest rolls around, which is a convention we like to go to here, or not every year, but we went to several times and would like to go back, that we'll be mostly done with the game by then. So yeah, we're excited.
Cool. So you're saying with the music, this is the first time you've been sort of, I guess, composing music. Who was doing the music for the other 2 games? Was it just you still, or someone else was helping you like compose the songs?
So for Nomalus, I actually used all public domain classical music for the game, and just transcribed classical music as the soundtrack. So it was mostly a composer named Domenico Scarlatti, who composed a whole bunch of harpsichord sonatas. There were a couple pieces by Bach and Soler and a couple of other Baroque composers, but most of it's by Scarlatti. And then Aulia, actually, I did compose the music for Aulia. A lot of them are simpler songs, I'd say, than what I'm currently trying to do for Trophy. For Trophy, I'm trying my very best to reach the level of quality that you might hear in one of the old Mega Man games. I don't know if I'm actually going to reach it, but I'm trying my best.
I'm sure it'll be sound good. So other than NES games, do you have any aspirations to, you know, go into more modern development, or even try and port like your NES games to like a more modern platform, for, like, I don't know, say Switch or Steam or something like that?
It's something I've definitely thought about, and I actually have already done to a certain degree. I actually did put Aulia on Steam. I actually got it in on Greenlight, like just a few months before they ended Greenlight. I don't even know how I did it, because I only had like 200 upvotes or something. So it was like this tiny amount of votes, but it got greenlit, and I got it on Steam. And made a few sales, and ironically, not as much as I have on cartridge. So I didn't really try very hard to promote it. And the way I got it on Steam was, I actually wrote a very minimalistic NES emulator to play my game on the PC. And it's actually not really an NES emulator because you could throw almost any other game at it and it won't work.
It's an Alia emulator.
I took the bare minimum features of what I needed from the NES emulator and just supported those for my game and was able to make it play really, really well on PC and put it on Steam. And it turned out to be a very painstaking process, both developing that software and publishing it on Steam. And I found I didn't really enjoy the whole process of getting a game ready for a modern digital distribution platform. So I'm not certain how much I'm actually going to be venturing into modern digital distribution in the future. I might, but I find that I enjoy retro coding and sort of the hobbyist way of doing so much that I'm just not motivated by praise and money at all. I just like to make games, so I'm probably going to stick in these sort of obscure hobby communities. So, well, one thing though that has really caught my attention and that I might spend more time on is something called Pico 8, which is a fantasy console, which is basically a piece of software that pretends to be an 8-bit computer that never existed, and it's got its own set of constraints and quirks that are different from actual old computers of the 8-bit era, and so it has its own charm and personality. And I've tinkered around with it a little bit and enjoy it a lot, and I can see myself making a lot of small games in that system. As during the development of these games, my NES games, I realized I'm getting quite fascinated with the art of actually developing a good and interesting game in terms of gameplay mechanics and so on. Like, even a simple arcade game can be really, really compelling and make you want to play it for hours. And learning why that is and crafting that sort of thing is becoming increasingly interesting to me. Whereas the NES games I made were sort of imitating existing material very, very closely and throwing in a lot of content. So along the way, I realized I really want to try my hand at actually crafting something with an interesting new gameplay mechanic or something. I can see Pico 8 being a nice platform on which to do that without necessarily, devoting another 5 years to a big actual indie project.
Right. Yep. Yep. So would you consider, say, another retro console, say like Super Nintendo or Mega Drive or something like that, like a different retro system? Would that interest you, or are you basically NES, you don't need really use the NES going forward if you ever did something a bit bigger again?
So I've thought about that quite a bit, and I have ideas for more NES games, but as each game is rather asset rich and complex, they take a long time, and I would like to try out things. And so sometimes I've thought about maybe doing Super Nintendo, but that would be even more complex asset wise. The possibilities on a Super Nintendo game are just immense. I mean, if you think about a Final Fantasy VI or a Donkey Kong Country, I mean, I'd need like a team of people to help me with something like that. Mm-hmm. But I've also considered possibly doing an Atari 2600. And I actually tinkered around with that system just a little bit a couple of months ago, just to see what it would be like. So I can see myself possibly messing with that system more, because it's the assets needed for such a game are so minimal. I can probably do the art because it's just, small little
squares.
Programming challenge could be very interesting to tackle, because instead of like on the NES, you can basically say this tile goes here and this tile goes here and this is its X and Y coordinate, and it just shows up on the screen. On the Atari, it's like as the electron beam is scanning the TV, you have to say, okay, this object's on here. Okay, and we're like a few CPU cycles later, we have to turn on this object here. And okay, we're on the next scan line, and we have to turn on the background pixel here, and then another. So you have to manage what the electron beam is doing for the entire screen, and the programming challenge of that is quite quite interesting. So I can see myself having some fun with that.
Cool. So as a sort of a closing question to lead out, what sort of games do you like to play? Like, what are you playing at the moment? Anything new, or do you sort of stick to the more retro games or whatever?
So I had been mostly retro for a number of years, and then just within the last few months, I suddenly decided I'm kind of starving for branching out some. And a friend of mine pointed me to a channel by a guy named Mark Brown, who talks about games. And that sort of piqued my interest, and I realized I'm really missing out on quite a few things. So I was getting back into Portal, which I tried some years ago, and it's not really a new game anymore, but it's new to me, and certainly newer than the stuff that I'm usually interested in. And so, I mean, that's just one example, but there's, you know, dozens and dozens of amazing games out there that I haven't tried, and I'm thinking of getting into those. Like right now, though, my focus is amusingly a retro game, Street Fighter II. I was terrible at fighting games as a kid, and I decided, okay, I'm going to learn how to play them now, and I've been obsessively playing Street Fighter II on my SNES Classic, and I actually found a book by some folks on a website called Shuriken.com that they wrote a book on how to basically not suck at fighting games. So I'm devouring that book while attempting to learn Street Fighter II.
Cool. All right, well, thank you for coming on and having a chat about Gradual Games and the stuff you've produced. If anyone has any questions for you, or you know, they just want to check out your stuff, they can go to your blog, which is gradualgames.com, which you can actually download your first two games for free now, the ROM files, and put it on EverDrive or play it on the computer or whatever. And you can also, like you said, still purchase the physical versions of the games, which would be cool for, you know, lots of people like physical stuff. And also you've got a Facebook page, which is just Gradual Games. You search for Gradual Games on Facebook, and I'm sure you would answer any questions or comments that people might have that you know, haven't heard about you guys before and are interested. So
I'm pretty active on Twitter too, at Gradual Games. That's where I'm posting most of my progress updates these days.
Okay, cool. Oh, thanks again, and everyone, thanks for listening, and until next time, this is Connectivity. Bye.